Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for September 15th, 2006. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. A few of the stories in today's show: the discovery of the oldest writing yet found in the New World, general relativity passes yet another test, and a genome sequence lovely as a tree. We'll have those stories and more, so stick around. First up today, the New World's oldest writing. In the September 15th issue of Science, a team including Carmen Rodriguez-Martinez of Mexico's National Institute of Anthropology and History, Stephen Houston of Brown University, and five colleagues report on the finding of a stone slab in Mexico with a hitherto unknown system of writing that likely represents the oldest writing in the Americas. Dr. Houston is on the line to give us the story. Dr. Houston, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, the oldest writing in the New World, so just how old are we talking about?
We're talking about an object that's probably about 1,000 years before Christ, before the beginning of the Common Era.
Maybe you could put it in some sort of context. I'm a little rusty on my Mesoamerican civilizations. Where does that stand in respect to the various ancient civilizations in this part of the world?
It is, in this part of the world, the oldest civilization. It's the first group of settlements and people that seem to be building very large pyramids, that are carving immense stone sculptures, and that are creating what can only be described as cities that had really immense sprawl to them. The greatest settlement of this period is, in fact, not too far from where this text was found, at San Lorenzo.
And these are the people called the Olmecs?
They are the Olmecs, yeah.
And how do they relate to the later civilizations, the Aztecs and the Maya?
The Maya were probably around at that point, but mostly were living in rather small villages. The Aztecs also probably had ancestors who were speaking their language around at that time as well, but they would still be many, many centuries, if not thousands of years, until the Aztecs were able to create their own empire.
So now, well, we have this slab from, you say, around 1,000 years before the Common Era, on which I gather is this previously unknown script. Can you tell us a bit about how that slab was actually found?
It was found by pure serendipity. A local person who owned this plot of land down in Veracruz, Mexico, needed some road construction material. And in this region, you get that by going for the nearest archaeological site, which has a lot of stone. And so he began digging there, and fairly soon they came across this block along with probably about a ton of ceramics. They knew that they were onto something quite interesting, and so they wrapped it up in a blanket and took it back to their small village along with as many of the artifacts as possible that were found nearby. And those are now all in this small town very close to Cascajal, where the block was recovered.
And so you had this block. How did you determine the age of this thing?
The problem with this kind of object is obvious in that it wasn't retrieved by archaeologists, but there's a lot of very, very strong circumstantial evidence that pinpoints this date. First, there are simply the ceramics that they found with it, which all date, with almost without exception, to this very early period when the great city of San Lorenzo was flourishing, and therefore we're pretty certain that that's what the block must date to as well.
By association with those other artifacts of known age by the style of those artifacts.
Exactly, exactly. And those are already very well dated from very solid archaeological work. There are some later ceramics, but they're so much later that they can't possibly be related to the block. And the reason we think that is because of the style of the icons, of the signs on the block, which are all, with a few exceptions, are just obviously from the Olmec civilization. The Olmec civilization had an extremely elaborate system of codified religious emblems, and some of the signs on the block are very clearly part of that system. But this is simply the first time in which it's been seen disposed into this kind of linear sequence that suggests that it's writing.
Well, so that's a kind of leads into the next question, which is, what is the larger significance of this in terms of Mesoamerican culture? We have this very old object, but what does it tell us that we don't know before?
It's a breathtaking find. It's the first clear evidence of literacy this early in the New World. And it's also an entirely new writing system. There had been these religious emblems or icons that we'd known about before, but this is the first time in which we've been able to see that this great civilization was literate. Now, that implies a lot of different things. A society or a civilization that's literate is presumably capable of accounting. It's capable of recording king lists in ways that can be transferred down the generations. It opens up a whole new world of administrative and even ritual or civic possibilities. All of that is now visible to us because of the discovery of the Cuscahel Block.
So it kind of limbs out the Olmec culture much more than it was before.
It gives us an entirely new perspective on that civilization.
Is there any idea of what the writing actually might mean?
There's the rub. It's awfully difficult to say because we have really just this one example, and there may be some stray finds over from other parts of Mexico that are part of the same system. But it's extremely difficult to decipher with such a small sample of text. Nonetheless, there are some indications from the iconographic parallels with some of the signs that indicate that the text might be referring to rulership in a few cases. There's also evidence, though, that the text was probably frequently erased and then replaced by other incisions because the top of the block is actually concave. This is something we really have not seen before in Mesoamerican writing.
So it wasn't set in stone.
It was. Exactly. And the material itself is stone, so it has this sense of being something rock hard, of course, but in fact it's a fairly soft stone, and it would be possible to erode it and then simply to incise again. Now, as to what was motivating that particular practice, we're still really unclear.
So you're going to need a little bit more, a few more of these things before you can figure that out.
That's the hope, that this will galvanize attention and that at the least there needs to be very serious archaeological work at the site of Cuscahel, and then more broadly, a renewed focus on these great cities, the Olmec, in this part of ancient Mexico.
Well, Dr. Houston, that's a terrific find. Thanks very much for joining us today and sharing it with us.
My great pleasure.
Stephen Houston is the co-author, with Carmen Rodriguez Martinez and five colleagues, of Oldest Writing in the New World, a research article in the September 15th issue of Science. You can find the article at the magazine's website at science.sciencemag.org. Also in Science this week, a sobering reassessment of the death toll in Darfur. Although estimates of the number of deaths in the Western Sudan crisis that began in February 2003 have varied widely, press reports since last year have tended to put the number in the tens of thousands, based mainly on one estimate by the U.S. State Department. In a Policy Forum article in the September 15th issue of Science, sociologist John Hagen of Northwestern University and Alberto Poloni of the University of Wisconsin present a new analysis that attempts to get past some of the confounding factors in earlier studies, including that of the State Department. Their conclusion? Based on the available data, the death toll in Darfur is conservatively estimated in the hundreds of thousands rather than the tens of thousands. Coming up in a moment, Einstein passes another test.
Did you know that AAAS members help plug the power of science into public policy? Since 1973, we've brought nearly 2,000 scientists and engineers to Washington, D.C. as science and technology policy fellows. They provide scientific analysis to policymakers in congressional offices and in federal agencies. Find out more at fellowships.AAAS.org. AAAS. Advancing science careers, enhancing public policy.
Almost 91 years ago, in November 1915, Albert Einstein published the gravitational field equations of general relativity. Ever since then, scientists have been devising new and ever subtler ways to test relativity theory, and perhaps poke a hole or two in the foundations of Einstein's edifice. Now, in a paper published online on Science Express, a team led by Michael Kramer of the University of Manchester reports on the most precise test of general relativity yet. Science news writer Adrian Cho covers the story in the September 15th issue. He's on the line to chat with us about it. Adrian, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So, Adrian, general relativity. I thought that was all settled.
Well, it depends on what you mean by settled. It's true that Einstein's theory is generally accepted as correct, the correct theory of gravity so far as we know. But it's equally true that the theory hasn't been directly tested all that often, and not to exquisitely high precision even then. There is, of course, the famous observation of an eclipse by Arthur Eddington and company in 1919 that showed that the sun's gravity bends light, which is a prediction of general relativity. But it wasn't until 1959 that researchers performed a laboratory experiment that showed that gravity can change the frequency and energy of light, which is also consistent with general relativity. More recently, scientists have shown that the sun's gravity delayed radio signals sent to the Cassini spacecraft. That experiment confirmed general relativity to about 0.002%, albeit in the relatively weak gravity of the sun. In contrast, Einstein's theory of special relativity, which has nothing to do with gravity, has been tested to many orders of magnitude better precision, as has quantum mechanics. So although there is no evidence to suggest general relativity needs a rethink, it's still worth testing the theory whenever the opportunity arises.
And so now we have a more precise test. What's new on the scene now that makes this possible?
Basically, nature smiled on astronomers and astrophysicists. In 2003, researchers discovered a so far unique astronomical object, a pair of pulsars about 1,700 light years away that whiz around each other every 2.5 hours. Pulsars are neutron stars, the corpses of certain dead stars that beam radio waves into space, and as they spin, that produces a regular pulsing of radio waves that's almost as steady as an atomic clock. And if the pulsar orbits another object, that pulsing repeatedly speeds up and slows down as the pulsar rushes towards and then away from Earth. That variation allows researchers to determine many details about the pulsar's orbit and how it evolves, which then lets them test general relativity. In fact, in the 1970s, Russell Hultz and Joe Taylor of Princeton University showed that such a pulsar very slowly spirals towards its partner, which means that it must emit gravity waves, and they won the Nobel Prize in 1993 for that. But having one pulsar doesn't allow you to determine all the parameters describing the orbit. Having two does. So when this double pulsar was discovered, it was pretty clear that it would allow for even better tests of general relativity.
So what did the research team do in this case?
Okay, so by tracking the variations in the pulsing of the two pulsars, the researchers were able to completely reconstruct the orbit of the pair. Now, if Isaac Newton's 1 over the distance squared law of gravity worked, that orbit would just be an ellipse, forever stationary on the sky. But if you throw in general relativity, which says that gravity is really the result of matter and energy warping space and time, then the orbit is more complicated. The ellipse rotates, it shrinks very slowly as the objects emit gravity waves, and so on. All these changes can be quantified in a handful of so-called post-Keplerian parameters. So what the researchers did was to determine a bunch of these parameters and then show that they were consistent with each other and also with the predictions of general relativity to within the uncertainties, which were as small as 0.05%.
Well, that's less precise than the Cassini, isn't it? You said 0.002%.
That's right, but there's a key difference, which is that the Cassini measurements were made in the relatively weak gravity of the sun. The new test is made in the gravitational field of a pulsar, which is so strong that the energy in the field itself causes space-time to warp. There's sort of a feedback effect. So it's a whole different realm where you might expect the theory to be stretched thinner than it would be in the solar system.
So they were looking at sort of general relativity in the extreme case.
That's right.
Well, in light of this, so now we have general relativity passing this extreme test down to a precision of 0.05%. Is there anywhere else really to go with this?
Well, collecting more data will decrease the uncertainties even farther, which will allow even more precise tests of general relativity, and that will obviously be welcomed by researchers because, you know, as we discussed before, the theory hasn't been tested all that many times. But perhaps more tantalizing, as the measurements become more precise, researchers might even be able to detect a subtle interplay between the motion of the pulsars around each other and the rate at which each of them spins on its axis. That would allow them to determine the moment of inertia of a neutron star, essentially the distribution of mass within it, and that would give them their first real peek inside a neutron star. That's cool because there are predictions that ultra-dense nuclear matter should form a bizarre free-flowing liquid known as a superfluid, but of course there's been no way to test this conjecture so far. So yes, by watching the double pulsar further, you know, we may learn some exciting things, and not just about general relativity, but about nuclear physics. That may take a decade or more, but the researchers seem willing to wait it out. So.
Well, hopefully it'll be worth waiting for. Adrian, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Adrian Cho writes this week on a new paper published online by Science that provides the most stringent confirmation yet of Einstein's general relativity. Look for it online at science.sciencemag.org. Also of interest this week on Science Express, a new paper discusses one possible geoengineering approach to forestall global warming. It's long been known that volcanic eruptions, which inject aerosols or aerosol precursors such as sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, can lead to short-term cooling of Earth's climate without disrupting the long-term climate system. Taking his cue from that pattern, Tom Wigley of the National Center for Atmospheric Research suggests that deliberate injection of sulfate aerosol precursors into the stratosphere might offer one way to straight-arm the onset of harmful climate change. The basic idea, increasing the aerosols means increasing the number of cloud condensation nuclei, thereby boosting the Earth's reflective cloud cover and counteracting some of the warming effects of elevated CO2 concentrations. The strategy isn't a permanent fix, and in the long run, carbon emissions would still need to be ratcheted down to avoid excessive acidification of the oceans. But Wigley argues that pursuing the geoengineering strategy over the next century could buy humanity some badly needed time to reduce dependence on fossil fuels and stem global warming's direst near-term threats. Just around the corner, the first tree genome sequence. Stay with us.
Did you know that the journal Science was founded by Thomas Edison in 1880? Even Edison's inventive mind could not have imagined its evolution into the world's leading journal of groundbreaking research and scientific news, in print and online. AAAS members can access seminars, podcasts, and all issues since 1880. Read today's stories and preview tomorrow's research, all at www.sciencemag.org. AAAS, advancing science into the future.
Genome sequencing of plants such as rice and Arabidopsis, the mustard weed that's a popular model of plant biology, has offered insights into plant growth and development. But these plants differ in many ways from their long-lived woody relatives, the trees. Now, in the September 15th issue of Science, an international team of researchers led by Gerald Tuscan of the Oak Ridge National Laboratory and University of Tennessee described the first draft genome of a tree species, specifically that of the black cottonwood, which thrives in the Pacific Northwest. Dr. Tuscan joins us today to talk about the team's findings. Dr. Tuscan, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, Dr. Tuscan, before diving into the details, we've got a number of plant genomes. Why do we need a tree genome at all? What makes trees different from other plants, biologically speaking?
Well, for the most part, trees are long-lived woody perennial plants. They have a lifestyle or a habit that's quite different than grasses or herbaceous annual plants. They form upright aerial structures. They face changing climatic conditions over their lifespans that are not commonly seen in annual plants.
So they're under sort of a variety of different stresses.
That's correct.
So why the black cottonwood in particular?
Well, cottonwood in general is one of the fastest growing temperate species in the world. It's been studied and used in commercial production for pulp and paper for decades now. So economically, it's an important species. Environmentally, it's important. It has one of the largest distributions of natural ranges among all plant species. It has a small genome. We had genetic maps available for it. It's transformable. There was a rich EST library available.
EST being express sequence tags?
That's correct, yeah. Yes. And it's relatively fast growing. And so if you were going to study a woody plant, you would want something that you could collect experimental data on in as short a period of time as possible. And the rapid growth of black cottonwood makes it a suitable candidate.
So it grows fast and also has a small genome that makes it easy to get your arms around.
That's correct. Yeah.
So you and your team sequenced this genome, a very large team.
Yes.
What did you actually find when you analyzed this genome?
We knew we would find genes or alleles at known genes that were specific to perennial growth, and we certainly found a lot of those. But one of the most interesting things, I think, was that the entire populace genome has gone through three whole genome duplication events. This is where each chromosome is doubled and the genome expanded by an order of twofold.
And there are several of these duplications.
And there were three of them that we can detect. The most recent is shared among all members of Salicaceae. The other appears to be shared with all Urosidids, and it occurred at the base of the split of Urosidid 1 and Urosidid 2, and we think that this is the same duplication that the Arabidopsis community has seen and has termed the beta duplication.
And the Urosidid family includes
all members of the Rosaceae, which include things like strawberry, peach, quite a range of plant species. Arabidopsis, of course, and all its brassica relatives, Populus, Salicaceae.
So this is a pretty broad family.
Yes, includes the legumes and all the members of the legume family as well.
So the black cottonwood has been through a lot, is what you're telling me.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more broadly about what this tells us about the evolution of trees versus that of other plants?
We began to look at the molecular clock and tried to decipher when did this most recent duplication take place. And based on nucleotide substitution rates, it appeared that the duplication was about 8 to 13 million years old. But based on the fossil records, we knew that members of Salicaceae, Populus in particular, was at least 65 million years old. And so the molecular clock and the fossil records were not in agreement. When we examined this closer, we began to understand that as a long-lived perennial organism, poplar in general has the opportunity to contribute gametes over hundreds of years, in some cases thousands of years. And so if an ancient genotype remained on the landscape for 5,000 years and entered into reproduction and successfully tossed its gametes into a future gene pool, the molecular clock then would be immediately set back to zero. So that 5,000 years would appear as if it had never happened.
Ah, so the fact that the molecular clock is out of sync with the fossil evidence, you're learning something about the way the molecular clock has worked in this species.
Behaves in this species, that's right. And so it's not ticking at the same rate that we see in Arabidopsis or rice, which are both herbaceous annual species.
So what's the next step? What sort of investigations will this new genome make possible?
Well, we've begun to look at those genes that are unique to woody perennial plants and have begun to understand and characterize how that expanded gene family is evolving and continuing to evolve under the selective pressure that a woody perennial plant experiences out in the wild. So because there were three whole genome duplication events, any gene may have up to eight copies, doubling. And when we look at individual genes, we find that some of those genes have been lost over time. Some of those genes have been maintained over time and, in fact, have expanded in the most recent period. So we begin to draw insights into what genes are important in terms of ecology, growth, and development for woody perennial plants.
And how about those of us in the animal kingdom? What does a better view of the molecular biology of trees mean kind of in the larger realm outside of plants?
Well, first of all, we begin to understand something about evolution of genomes, how a doubled genome reorganizes itself and behaves like a diploid organism, and how chromosome structures are actually reorganized and redeveloped. And that then would be informative to animal genomes. But more importantly, I think, there are no new genes. And so as gene families expand, as new gene functions are selected, favored by natural selection, we can begin looking at populace and compare it to its nearest relatives in the Urosidid family or in the Urosidid clade. But we can also go beyond that, further back into evolutionary time, compare dicots with monocots or angiosperms with gymnosperms. And we can go even further back and look at how have genes evolved since the first single-cell organisms existed, and understand how domains are exchanged among genes, how genes begin to expand and mutate, and with that, we gain an insight into their function.
So there's a lot left to do.
There's a lot left to do.
Well, Dr. Tuscan, on that note, congratulations on the work, and thanks for talking with us today.
On behalf of the team that pulled this together, thanks for allowing this opportunity to speak to you today.
Gerald Tuscan and an international team of researchers report on the sequencing of the black cottonwood genome in the September 15th issue of Science. Finally today, we have David Grimm, the editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now, with us to give us a look at some other recent stories. David, welcome.
Good to be here.
So what's on the lineup today, David?
Got three cool stories. I'm going to tell you why cleaner people really do have cleaner minds, why Earth and planets like it may not be one in a billion. And finally, I will tell you how the chimp crossed the road.
How the chimp crossed the road. Well, we'll start with cleanliness and clean minds. What's
right.
that all about?
So I think everybody's heard the phrase, cleanliness is next to godliness. And for a while now, researchers have thought that there might actually be a real association between people who sort of have clean minds and clean bodies. For example, we use the word pure to describe both your body but also your thoughts. But, you know, nobody had really tested this idea of how related these concepts really are.
So how would you test such a thing?
Well, a group of researchers at Northwestern University in Chicago came up with a really intriguing way to do this. They rounded up a group of about 30 undergraduate students, and they had them think either ethical or unethical thoughts. So the ones that thought ethical thoughts thought about maybe helping out a sick friend. The ones that thought unethical thoughts thought about maybe something like shoplifting. And then they had the participants complete a four-letter word that started with W and ended with H. So they had to fill out the two blanks in between. And what they found is the people that had thought the unethical thoughts tended to fill out that word with a clean word, like wash, whereas those who had thought the ethical thoughts tended to choose a neutral word like wish.
So they were mentally cleansing themselves.
They were sort of mentally cleansing themselves, exactly. And what was also interesting is they also gave the same participants the choice between getting an antiseptic wipe or getting a pencil as a gift for participating in the study. And those that had sort of thought the unclean thoughts were twice as likely to take the wipe than they were to take the pencil. So again, it was sort of a way of physically cleansing themselves to sort of make up for their unethical thoughts. And they did one more experiment where they took the participants again and they asked them to describe an unethical deed from their past. And afterwards, about half were given a wipe to clean their hands. And those that received the wipe, the researchers asked them, would they be willing to help out a desperate graduate student in need? And those that had taken the wipe were about half as likely to offer help than those who hadn't taken the wipe.
So they figured by using the wipe, they'd taken care of everything.
They're right. They were clean enough. They didn't do anything else to clean themselves. So it's sort of a really interesting way to test sort of how we associate mentally cleanliness with sort of physical cleanliness.
So if a politician tells us they have clean hands, we should ask a follow-up question.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, so what else do you have here? Alien seas.
Yeah, so, you know, there's been a big debate about how many other planets out there in the universe might be like Earth. And what people are really interested in is there life out there. And, you know, for a planet to harbor life, astronomers think that it has to have water and it has to sort of be Earth-like in size and distance from the sun. And there's a lot of controversy about what are the chances that there's actually another world like ours out there. And one of the reasons that some astronomers are pessimistic about this has to do with something called hot Jupiters. And hot Jupiters are planets about the size of Jupiter. They orbit very closely to their sun, about as close as Mercury orbits to our sun. And when the solar systems with these hot Jupiters form, astronomers thought that, well, when these solar systems form, it's basically a sun surrounded by a big, what they call protoplanetary disk, which basically contains all the ingredients for making planets. And hot Jupiters are usually the first to form. And so what astronomers thought is when these hot Jupiters form and they start plowing through this protoplanetary disk, they basically vacuum up all of these ingredients and sort of make themselves bigger.
So they're forming sort of relatively far out to start, but they're kind of migrating in.
They're migrating in towards the sun. But as they do that, the astronomers are thinking, have thought that as they do this, they're basically collecting more and more material, basically sucking up any material that would be needed to create an Earth-like planet. And any material they don't suck up, astronomers have thought these hot Jupiters basically just shoot out off into space. And so they're not available to make Earths. But a team of astronomers at the University of Colorado Boulder ran a bunch of simulations over 8 months on, you know, dozens of desktop computers, and they saw sort of the opposite thing happening. These hot Jupiters, when they form, they do kick out a lot of this material in the protoplanetary disk, but they don't really kick it out of the solar system. They actually kick it out into more habitable regions of the solar system, where it'd be a little bit farther from the sun, and more likely in a zone where the planet would be cool enough, where it might be conducive enough for life. And they also found that this process seems to cause comets in the protoplanetary disk to shoot towards these potential Earth-like planets, and these comets are rich in ice and water, and when they hit the planets, they'd be supplying the planets with water. So they sort of found the opposite thing. So you
end up with Jupiter orbiting close to the sun, but with Earth-like planets outside of
exactly,
that orbit.
Exactly. So obviously it's just a model, but it does contradict what a lot of astronomers had assumed, and gives the idea that there could be a lot more Earth-like planets out there than we thought.
And that's because so far the planets outside the solar system have tended to include these hot Jupiters.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
So, and finally, male chimpanzees as crossing guards, I think. Is that what we're talking about?
That's sort of what we're talking about. And you know, male chimps get a bad rap, and probably deservedly so. You know, male chimps have this reputation for killing baby chimps of females that they want to mate with because they want kids that are their own.
Yikes.
Yeah, so they're not viewed as very nice guys. But a group of researchers in Guinea in West Africa noticed something really unusual. There was a small village where there was two different kinds of roads. There was a really narrow road where pedestrians cross, and it's a very safe road. And there's a much wider road that cars use, and that's obviously a much less safe road. And then this team was observing a group of 12 chimps, and what they found was that when the chimps were crossing the safe road, they sort of thought about it for about 30 seconds, but then just crossed without any problem. But when they were confronted with the dangerous road, they thought about it for 6 minutes. So they were really evaluating the risks inherent in this road with the traffic and everything else. But what was the most interesting is what they found is when the chimps eventually decided to cross the road, it was the high-ranking male chimps that both led the group and basically brought up the front and brought up the rear. And in the middle were the female and the young chimps. So in other words, the males are sort of taking the front. They're taking the brunt of the danger by crossing first, and they're also in the back to make sure everything's sort of safe in the back. So they are sort of acting like crossing guards, and they're also kind of protecting the whole group, right. And so they're basically keeping the whole group safe, and it's sort of a nice corollary to show that male chimps aren't all bad guys.
Not as bad as we thought.
Well,
David, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Meanwhile, if you're interested in more audio on recent scientific discovery, check out the Science Update podcast from AAAS at scienceupdate.com. And that wraps up the September 15th, 2006 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science. Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the podcast, and our producer is Barnaby Bristol. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor. On behalf of Science and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.